Dr. Michael Roizen.
Dr. Michael Roizen.
You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
You're listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Podcast, iHeart Radio MD. Those are the places you can download us. Thanks for downloading us. You obviously did. Do tell your friends about us. Do write us if you have questions. ageprooflife@gmail.com. If you have suggestions for guests. And we have a great guest today, Dr. Samuel Harrington, HARRINGOGTON, is the author of At Peace, Choosing a Good Death After a Long Life. It's published by Grand Central Publishing, which actually did our book, Age Proof. Dr. Harrington, thanks for coming on.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to about elderly patients making better end-of-life decisions.
Well, tell us, how did you first of all, what's the real purpose of the book? Is it to help people make better life decisions towards the end? Is it to help caregivers? Is it to help family members? Who is it to help, or is it really for the person who is dying themselves?
It is specifically for elderly patients and their families who will be assisting them in making end-of-life decisions. And it came out of my 35 years of training and practice when I observed what I perceived to be too many patients, elderly patients, dying in intensive care units without understanding the implications of all their treatments and without understanding when they went into the hospital and subsequently the intensive care unit that would be the outcome.
And when do most people think, and I guess this is discussed in the book, so I pretend that I haven't read it and the audience clearly hasn't, but should get this book. I mean, it's a wonderful book. But do most people think they have a much better chance of surviving than they do, or do most physicians underestimate or overestimate? Nick Christakis, who was at Harvard and is now, I think, at Yale, always had the idea that physicians' predictions of death were wildly in error, both positive and negative.
Yeah, absolutely. I note in the book that when physicians were trying to estimate how long a patient would survive in hospice care, 20% were accurate, 17% were pessimistic, meaning the patient lived a little bit longer than the doctor predicted, and 63% were wildly optimistic, frequently by a factor of 5 as to how long the patient would live. So if they thought a patient would live for 5 months, it turned out they lived for less than a month. And the point of understanding our biases, and I tend to fall in the pessimistic category, I'm afraid, is that we falsely recommend treatments to patients if we think they're going to live longer than they will. And then we raise their hopes, and which is good up to a point, but false hope is a cruel complication of too much treatment. And so I think he makes a very good point. I think he says that we physicians, in an effort to treat our patients therapeutically, abandon them prognostically, and I think that's very valid.
Which is an erudite way of saying that we are very aggressive in treating and don't do enough to have patients, quote, at peace, don't do enough in talking to patients about where they want to die and whether they want to die at home. Am I interpreting that correctly?
I think you are. I think both from a doctor and patient point of view. I think a moment ago I was talking about the doctors who have over expectations. And then, of course, patients have, in this day and age, have over expectations. But we have to keep in mind that 80 to 90% of patients, I misspoke, 80 to 90% of elderly patients in all medical studies express a preference to die at home, at peace, at quietly and as peacefully as possible. But 60% of elderly patients die in institutions, and that disconnect is something I'm trying to deal with in the book by pointing out that it is fundamental that if you die at home, you have to be prepared. One has to be prepared, or their family member speaking for them, to say no to aggressive treatment, to say no to hospitalization.
Yeah, and that, now, what's the role of the advanced directives in this, and in the legal implications of it? In other words, I'm going to give you a story that is, I'm really proud of my mother-in-law in this. My father-in-law had smoked and had small cell cancer of the lung, and had already signed a DNR, et cetera. And obviously it was not well communicated in the ICU where he was, and just had a fresh diagnosis. And as he was arresting, they started to do CPR, and my mother-in-law stopped the resident and said, "Didn't you see he was DNR, meaning do not resuscitate?" And he and my mother-in-law were able to die in peace of that, rather than have a prolonged death, as I
right.
think that's, you contain
the
you
death prolonged
you write
by
about
violent
it.
Technology. Well. Right. The role of the DNR in this case was overlooked in terms of the written role, but your mother-in-law verbalized appropriately the oral role. And one of the points of the book is that it's important to have a written advance directive, but it's more important to have a unified family, because most decisions, medical decisions, made in an urgent situation are made in real time and verbally, and not made by parsing the written advance directive. So your mother-in-law was fortunate to be there and to have the strength of character to stand in and defend your father-in-law's wishes. And I applaud that. But everybody has to have both a set of written advance directives and a set of conversations with their family to establish oral updates and sort of more detailed intentions, perhaps.
We're talking with Dr. Samuel Harrington, author of At Peace, Choosing a Good Death After a Long Life. Dr. Harrington, how did you choose the title for this book?
Well, it was, I was trying to work toward peace in the title, because I think it's a work in progress, and the editors and publishers felt that At Peace was an adequate way of doing it without invoking kind of a war peace kind of process. And choosing a better good death after a long life sort of summarizes the book, because it really focuses on elderly patients. But of course, most of us don't think of ourselves as elderly, because that's for somebody else. That's a problem somebody else has. No matter how old we are, somebody else is older. But the CDC clusters everybody above the age of 65 in the same demographic. So I, at age 67, am clustered with 97-year-olds. And I, of course, feel younger than they are. But the fact is that we are all demographically old, and our immune systems, for example, are weakening after age 60. So we have to make some preparations for getting old.
When should one do advanced directives, and how often should one look at them and think about changing them?
Well, the advance directive should grow as we age. So when we're a young adult, it is probably adequate to advise our families that we don't, in the case of brain death due to a motor vehicle accident, we don't want to be sustained indefinitely, or some variation on that fairly simple theme. We don't want to be sustained if we have brain injury. We don't want to be sustained cancer, but if a young person will have a chance to have, work up toward decision-making for a terminal cancer. So I should move back to my original point that at a young age, we have to prepare for one kind of disease, such as a brain injury. But at an older age, we have to prepare for multiple diseases, and we have to adapt to the diseases that we're diagnosed with. So our advanced directives have to become increasingly sophisticated. But again, I want to point out that the oral history, the oral wishes are equally important in communication. I'll use my father as an example. When he and I worked on his advance directive, he was a lawyer and I was helping him edit it, and he had written it in such a way that I wanted to incorporate a few things that he was willing to do or interested in at the time, but it was still an academic discussion. When we got down into the weeds at a later date, when he was 88 and he was diagnosed with an aortic aneurysm in his abdomen, and I was outlining treatment options for him, he cut me short and he asked me, "Why, Sam, why would I want to fix something that is going to carry me away the way that I want to go?" Meaning that he thought that if his aneurysm ruptured, he could decline emergency surgery and take palliative pain medication. And he had some knowledge of this because he had witnessed one of his legal clients in that circumstance. So my point is that that vision of a rapid death became part of his oral advanced directive that my sisters and I used when we made further decisions with him, because he never really became incompetent until the last very few days. But we made decisions with him that would accept the possibility of a rapid death if he and palliative care if certain circumstances arose.
Now, I think you deal with this pretty well in the book, but let's just talk about what happened. A lot of us as physicians think that science is advancing fast enough that our, quote, predictions may prove wrong 3 or 5 years in the future. That is, we're seeing rapid changes in ability to influence diseases. And if you will, some people are predicting that, for example, we will be able to reverse Parkinson's disease within 3 to 5 years. How do you take that into account in the, if you will, the planning or the planning for death if you, for example, have Parkinson's disease?
Well, I'm not an expert in Parkinson's. I'm not a neurologist, but I think that most of the science as we see it coming out is overly optimistic, and we hear about it and think that things are going to happen faster than they do. I don't really think I'm not studied up on Parkinson's at this very moment, but I would be surprised. I personally would be surprised if it was solved in the next few years. I think that we gain much more data as time goes on and we get new treatments, but I think that they bring with them complications and other issues that we and complexity that we have to deal with. So I think that I'm not one of the more overly optimistic people in this regard, but I think we have to take everything with a grain of salt in this day and age, because we get inundated with an enormous amount of information, some of which is accurate and much of which is not. I quote a couple of the editors from the two greatest Western medical journals, the New England Journal of Medicine and the Lancet, in the back matter of my book. And I'll read one of those quotes from Richard Horton. "Much of the scientific literature, perhaps half, may simply be untrue. Afflicted by studies with small sample sizes, tiny effects, invalid exploratory analyses, and flagrant conflicts of interest, together with an obsession for pursuing fashionable trends of dubious importance, science has taken a turn towards darkness. Well, that's a pretty grim prediction right there, and I think that we have to take everything with a grain of salt and try and be as practical and realistic as possible.
And I think it's dealt with by the revisions to planning that one gets into as time goes on. So I thought you dealt with it well. The book is At Peace, Choosing a Good Death After a Long Life. It's published by Grand Central Publications. The author is Dr. Sam Harrington. Before we let you go, Dr. Harrington, I don't think, although you mentioned your 35 years, I don't think we mentioned enough about your own background and the way you came to this. You were a graduate or are a graduate of Harvard College and the University of Wisconsin Medical School, and have now been at Sibley Memorial Hospital. I assume that is outside of Washington, D.C., but it's part of the Hopkins system where you've been helping people make such decisions for a number of years.
That is correct. I was a trustee at Sibley Hospital, which, as you say, is a member of the Johns Hopkins health system for 13 years. And I was a trustee of a local hospice in Washington, D.C. At the time, it was called Hospice Care of D.C., and it was subsumed under the umbrella of Capital Caring, a very large hospice in the Mid-Atlantic states.
So I don't think this book is just for those at the end. I think this is for something that a lot of us should promote from the medical profession, but also that this is a reasonable thing to think about well in advance of events. Is that how you designed it? Or it seems to me this is for a very broad audience, not just people in hospice care, not just people who have serious diseases, but all of us, and not just caregivers, but all of us to think about and how we want to die and what our thoughts are and how do we convey that to our family.
I appreciate that. That is exactly what I'm trying to say. I want elderly patients, people over the age of 65, to think of themselves as candidates for this book and the decision making, and I want their children to understand what their parents are thinking. So I want their children to think about the concepts I raise in the book. I don't expect people to agree with everything I say, but I think a fresh look is appropriate for people as they move along. And elderly patients, their children, their caregivers, all should be thinking in a progressive way about how they're going to deal with these issues as they approach.
We've been talking with Dr. Samuel Harrington, author of At Peace, Choosing a Good Death After a Long Life. You've been listening to podcast 886B, the guest segment, obviously, of You, the Owner's Manual radio podcast. Thanks for downloading us. If you like this subject, or even if you don't, you feel free to write us at ageprooflife@gmail.com. If you have other suggestions for guests, please do email us. And I want to thank Ben for great engineering, you for downloading us. Please do rate us. Thanks again. Remember, You, the Owner's Manual podcast, a new one every Tuesday, both the latest news of the week and what it means to you, much more important than the latest news, but what it means for you so that you can live at the top of your curve till you decide to be at peace, as Dr. Harrington says. Thanks again, and thank you, Ben, for great engineering. We'll be back next week.